Mr. Cordo, good morning to you. Ms. Osborne, good morning to you. Do either of you have any questions before we begin? Then, Mr. Porto, you may approach and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Mark Porto. I'm here today on behalf of my client, Fabian Lara. I'll begin by just giving a brief recitation of the facts. This case involved a scenario where some friends of my client were being investigated for having potentially stolen a bobcat. Law enforcement was at a residence securing the property while some law enforcement officers were in the process of getting a search warrant to search the residence. Apparently some communication was made between those inside the residence and my client, who then showed up at the residence and obviously in a misguided effort to distract law enforcement officers, shot a couple of shots over the head of the officers. Those are the basic circumstances of the case. There was no contest pleas were entered pursuant to a plea agreement. And what we're here today to discuss and our concern about this case is whether Mr. Lara received what he was promised by the state in order to get him to not exercise fundamental constitutional rights and enter pleas to these charges. Specifically, the state, as part of the plea agreement, agreed to recommend a total sentence of 15 to 20 years.
And that's what the prosecutor did, right?
The prosecutor did, but the state did not. What?
Well, that depends on how you define the state, doesn't it?
It does, but I believe that law enforcement officers are accurately described to be part of the state. And that is a position that is consistent with the weight of authority from around the country. What happened here is, notwithstanding
the... Is a law enforcement officer in this situation also a victim?
He was.
A named victim in the complaint that was, of the charge that was pled to, correct?
Right, that's correct. I don't believe that changes the characterization of the law enforcement officer as still a member of the state.
If he had wrote the letter on his own stationery, didn't identify himself as an investigator of the Grand Island Police Department, does that change your thought process?
I don't believe so. I mean, maybe a little, but I certainly think it adds weight to the characterization of the officer as an agent of the state when he puts his name on letterhead from police stationery.
Well, I can't recall if you were trial counsel.
Yes, I was.
Okay. When that occurred in the sentencing proceeding, you asked to strike the part of those. You didn't ask to withdraw the plea. You didn't ask to have specific performance. You asked for redaction, I think would be a fair characterization, right?
Right.
And the state actually agreed. The state's attorney actually agreed to that. But for some reason, the trial judge did not do that.
Correct. We did object to the receipt of the letter. Later in the back and forth with the judge, we asked to have that portion where the officer specifically asks not to follow the sentencing recommendation that the state had promised to make my client in order to get him to take a plea.
Now, the trial judge declined to do what was requested and consented to by the state's attorney, there was no motion or request at that point in time to withdraw the plea or to specifically perform, was there?
There was not. That scenario was consistent with a number of cases throughout the country. I don't remember the specific names, but I know there's case law that to the effect that you don't need to ask for you don't need to do a motion to withdraw the plea at that time. It doesn't change the fact that the defendant is entitled to receive the benefit of the bargain that they made with the state.
Under your theory, when did the breach of the plea agreement occur? Is it upon submission of the officer's letter? Is it when the judge says he'll receive it? Is it some other time?
That's a good question. I would say that the breach by the state occurred at the time of the submission of the letter.
So does it even matter under your theory what the trial court does? I mean, is it receive it or not, the state has breached the plea agreement?
Right. I think that's correct. Because ultimately the remedy that we're asking for is a new sentencing hearing with a judge that is not, that does not have this, the information received from the contents of the letter, which did violate the plea agreement.
Did you ask for that judge to recuse themselves or disqualify themselves before pronouncing sentence?
I did not.
Based on the court's decision to receive the letter and consider for what value it is.
I did not ask that in the moment. I do believe that case law is uniform, that that is the remedy in the event that the court does find that there's been a breach of the plea agreement.
But you don't have to do that in advance.
No, no.
It does have sort of the smell of, well, there's a smell from the law enforcement officer. There's that smell already in, but then it has a smell of gambling on a favorable result. How do you respond to that?
Well, I would disagree with that, because in the moment there was an objection made to the receipt of the letter. There was an objection made to the content of and asked to have that stricken. I think that's all you can expect defense counsel to do. I don't think defense counsel has an obligation at that precise moment. I don't think there's case law that says that that the defense has an obligation at that moment to ask the judge to recuse themselves or to withdraw the plea at that moment.
Or file a motion to disqualify the judge.
Or file a motion to disqualify the judge. Those things do not have to happen precisely in that moment.
Would you disagree that there was an opportunity to do that that was not taken, and take that further? Your argument would be, yes, there was an opportunity, but no, defense counsel doesn't have to do it. Is that what your position
yes.
is?
That's what my position is, yes. It doesn't alleviate the problem. The problem at the end of the day is that the state made a promise to Mr. Lara that in exchange for you giving up these fundamental constitutional rights, we will make this recommendation to the judge. And that just didn't happen.
So it's your position that the victim officer here who was shot at by your client should be precluded from being able to provide any victim impact information to a judge?
Absolutely not. We addressed that in depth in the brief.
Your position then the content that he can provide should be restricted, what he can talk about?
Restricted in just a very, very, very minimal way.
Lay that out for me.
Okay. The statute that allows for victims to write to the judge is 81-1848 subsection 1D4. And what that says is that a victim is provided a statutory right to submit an impact statement. I have absolutely no disagreement with Your Honor about the ability of Investigator Sullivan as a victim to write to the court and explain the trauma that he went through as a result of this, if any, the impact on his life, if any, the continuing, struggles that he's had as a result of this, and even advocate for a sentence consistent with the state's recommendation. The only problem that we had with the letter fundamentally was the explicit advocation by Investigator Sullivan for the court not to follow the promise that the state made to Mr. Lara.
I beg your pardon, could Officer Sullivan, wearing his hat as mere victim, have written the victim impact statement, right, and describe the trauma he has since experienced and say, something inflammatory, hang him, something greater than the deal?
No, I think the line is crossed.
Well, is he either a mere victim or is he's a mere victim for getting that rid of the letterhead, but he's now an officer of the state when he speaks to what he would like to see with respect to the defendant's sentence?
I think he, at all times, is an agent in the state. He's also a victim.
If the circumstances were exactly the same, except this person was not an officer, was not an employee of the state, was simply someone on the street who happened to be there when the events went down and said everything that he said in the letter, but didn't have any connection with the state, what effect would that be?
We would not be here.
Okay.
What if instead of the officer was the county treasurer?
I think that's a more difficult question. I know I'm out of time. May I answer this question?
You certainly may.
Okay. I think we want
to hear the answer.
that's a much more difficult question. Because law enforcement officers are so clearly agents of the state justice realm, and so in that context. The law enforcement goes hand in hand with the prosecution and the state. And I go through some statutes that allow law enforcement officers to sit at counsel table during trials. And there's other things that we lay out that indicate that in that specific instance, putting aside the issue of the treasurer, which I don't have a good answer for, this was an agent of the state. And this was also not a victim impact letter. This was a letter from a police investigator.
This is not an officer once again, are there any limitations in statute or anywhere else that you could point us to that limit what a victim can say when they've addressed the court?
There aren't really. The statute is pretty broad. It just says victim impact statement. I don't know what that means other than if the victim is also an agent of the state, it's our position that that letter, that impact statement cannot advocate for a sentence beyond what the state promised to get in exchange for a defendant to waive their constitutional rights.
I promise my last question. I'll keep you after this. Does it have any impact whatsoever that the trial court judge accepted this, I'm going to try quotes because I can't, for whatever weight it's worth as a victim's opinion?
It's the fact that that was a position by an agent of the state that was advocated to the judge. That's the problem.
Thank you.
I apologize. One question.
Can't blame me for this one.
I think you said it earlier, but are you conceding that this investigator Sullivan is a victim of the offense?
I can't disagree with that. He was listed on there and it was as a victim in the count that we pled to. So I can't take issue with him submitting a letter as a victim. It's what he said in that letter is the problem.
The content.
And the content.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Osborne, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Jordan Osborne, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of the state of Nebraska. This appeal involves only a sentencing issue, and that specifically is whether Investigator Sullivan acted in his capacity as a victim or in his capacity as a police officer.
Was the letter a hybrid? For some purposes he's an officer of the state, but in some purposes he's a mere victim?
No. He submitted the letter as a victim. The court.
How do you reconcile that with the stationery, the badge?
Well, I would disagree. This is not law enforcement stationery. It's a blank sheet of paper that he's added. He added some type of an emoji, some type of an image in the signature line. That there's no. Stationery or heading or anything at the top of the page is just a blank sheet of paper that he's added an image to at the bottom. So he's representing himself as a law enforcement officer, which there's nothing improper about him representing himself as a law enforcement officer. He is, in fact, a law enforcement officer, and he was working as a law enforcement officer when the appellant chose to fire two shots in his direction. According to State versus Stewart, which is a Wisconsin case that I've cited, they talk about that same thing, that there's nothing improper about the victim who happens to be an officer representing themselves as an officer.
So commonly people will remark, people who are in public life say, I'm speaking only for myself, not the state, or so forth, right? If that had language to that effect, would that have cured it?
Well, the letter itself, actually, at the beginning of the letter, he says that I've received a victim notification for this case, and essentially indicates that that's why he's writing the letter. He's writing the letter as a victim. The court receives the letter as a victim's opinion. So,
well, what do you make of the specific language that says you should not follow the plea agreement? That may not be specifically, right. But essentially he says that.
Right. He's writing the letter.
Do not follow what the prosecutor has agreed to here.
He's writing the letter in his capacity as a victim in this case. And victims are not bound by the state's agreement. So here we have a situation where victims are not agents of the state, even if they're working as a police officer when they become a victim. And any promise that the state made to recommend a particular sentence was not binding on this victim, even though he's a police officer.
So I think Mr. Porto cites some cases from other jurisdictions that essentially came to a different conclusion than the Wisconsin case. How do you address those?
All of the cases that he cited are distinguishable because they do not involve a police officer who was a victim. The three cases that the state has directed the court's attention to are directly on point. They involve police officers who were victims. And every single one of those courts found that there was no breach of the plea agreement due to the officer's request for a longer sentence than what was agreed to be recommended by the state. In other words, a police officer who is a victim is not bound by any sentencing recommendations agreed to by the state in a plea agreement.
Under Nebraska's sentencing scheme, how would an officer offer information to a court if they weren't a victim? Do they have an avenue to do so?
In Nebraska, in my experience, I've never seen that happen. I don't know under what authority a law enforcement officer would offer some type of recommendation to the court about sentencing if they are not a victim. Some other states, apparently, it was new information to me, but some other states apparently allow for that in their statutory framework. Nebraska does not. So I don't think that would ever happen unless the police officer is a victim. They're offering their statement as a victim in the case.
Not, for example, a member of the community, right? I've known this defendant for a long time. She's a good person.
Well, support letter, I guess theoretically, I think you probably could have somebody offer a support letter that maybe is associated with law enforcement. I think I've seen like corrections officers or people who maybe work at the jail provide a support letter to a defendant because they've had some type of interaction with them. But in terms of just a law enforcement officer providing some type of a recommendation for a longer sentence than what the state agreed to, I don't think that there would be any way that would occur within the statutory framework because our statutes don't provide law enforcement officers to just submit recommendations to the court. Our statutes allow victims to submit recommendations and comments to the court.
If we follow your reasoning and adopt your position, doesn't that undermine prosecutors' ability to make plea agreements?
No, I don't think it undermines the prosecutor's ability whatsoever. If you have a victim who is not a police officer, or if you do have a victim who is a police officer, the circumstances are the same. Victims are not powerless to disagree with the state. Their voice, they can voice their disagreement to the sentencing court, and in this particular case, any advocacy for a longer sentence than what was recommended as part of the plea agreement was within Investigator Sullivan's role as a victim. So that would apply whether you're a police officer or not. If you're just a member of the community and you disagree with what the state is going to recommend as part of the plea agreement,
is there
they can voice that disagreement.
So If the letter had been a little more supple, and it may have said, I'm writing a letter as a victim impact statement for the charge of assaulting an officer or whatever, right? Because I'm an officer, right? And I'm writing this letter in my capacity as a victim, and I think the sentence should be X. Is that okay?
Well, I don't think that there's anything wrong with the way that the letter was written. He indicates that he was prompted to write the letter. He was notified about his right to write the letter because he is a victim in this case. He's a victim of the defendant.
And he identifies the crime.
He identifies what the defendant did, which was shoot at police officers.
Well, and as such, I am a victim under this certain statute.
The appellant concedes that he is a victim under this statute. He's a named victim in count three.
Thank you.
I don't think that's that's a disputed issue here. He is a victim in this case.
There's also some information provided beyond the incident in this case, right? That he sort of goes on to say, well, since this arrest, things have calmed down. Is he speaking as a victim when he moves beyond the crime charged?
He's speaking from his own perceptions, his own feelings about...
As a victim or as a law enforcement officer?
I think he's speaking as a victim. He's indicating his personal experience. He's not basically saying, I went into our Grand Island Police Department records and I pulled the data from this, and I can prove that there's fewer shootings. He's talking about...
Is there a Snapchat that's attached to the letter or incorporated in the letter?
There's an image that was attached to the letter. The image is...
Would an ordinary person have a copy of a Snapchat from somebody in the Grand Island community? Or is that based on some law enforcement investigation?
Well, I don't... The letter doesn't indicate where
evidence locker? Do we know where the Snapchat came
from? We don't know where the Snapchat came from.
Would he have gotten the Snapchat because he was shot at?
I don't know where he got the Snapchat or where he got the social media posting. It's not indicated in the letter. There's nothing in the Snapchat that's investigative in nature. It's not part of this case. It's not part of any other particular case. There's nothing about it.
Well, which way does that cut?
I don't think that there's anything about the Snapchat that somehow makes the reference to it, him speaking in his capacity as an officer. He's basically just expressing just his personal feelings about the appellant and his co-defendants. He felt that once this group of individuals was arrested, that there was a noticeable decline in the shootings in the community. We do know from the record that the appellant was involved in a significant number of other criminal offenses prior to this incident.
Does Mr. Lara have a responsibility once he makes the objection to the judge to disregard this information? The judge says, I'm going to receive it and only consider it for the weight I give it. Does he have a duty at that point then to seek a disqualification of that judge or ask that the judge recuse him or herself from the case? Does there any obligation to do that?
I think that would be up to this court to determine. I don't know that there's any case law out there that says one way or the other whether there's a requirement that you ask for the judge to recuse themselves. There is the Landera case. The Court of Appeals has language in it that indicates that if you do not move to withdraw your plea, you can only seek the remedy on appeal of specific performance, so just essentially a resentencing. You can't undo the plea agreement. So I think that there is some language about, you know, what your appellate remedy is based on what you do in the trial court, but I don't know about language with judicial disqualification.
I just want to make sure I understand what your ultimate position is with respect to whether when a law enforcement officer is a victim of a charged crime and the state through the county attorney has made a plea bargain. Is there anything that the law enforcement officer's victim statement could say that would cross the line?
Well, I think...
Or is it, it's wide open?
I think arguably there could be, I mean, if the entire statement is all about, you know, this is what was in this police report and this was, the defendant did this and this and this and this and this based on all these police reports and this is the investigative information that we accrued throughout this case, and they're somehow presenting, basically, they're presenting a closing argument, as you would to a jury, about this is why this person is guilty and this is all the things that they've done, and I know all of this through my investigative resources. I guess potentially that could be, there could be a difference there.
Aren't
but
the police reports already going to be in the pre-sentence?
They are already in the pre-sentence. I mean, the judge already knows all that information. It's not new to the judge. So
your position really is nothing that the law enforcement officer slash victim can say that would be construed to violate a plea bargain?
I'm not aware of any case, and the appellant hasn't cited to any, I haven't found any, where a law enforcement officer wrote a victim impact statement, and that victim impact statement was a breach of the plea agreement.
I beg your pardon, is that the only question on deck? Is this a violation of a plea agreement?
That's the objection that was made before the district court, and that's the assignment of error on appeal. So I think all we're looking at here is, did the recommendation for a longer term than what the state was going to recommend violate the plea agreement?
And what the state actually recommended.
And the state actually recommended exactly what it promised to recommend.
We're dividing the two. The prosecutor did recommend.
The prosecutor did recommend exactly what they agreed to recommend.
Was that recommendation continued after the receipt of the letter? Was there any wavering of that by the state? Did the state waver on that recommendation in any manner after the court received this letter from the
Absolutely not. And in fact, there's no evidence that the prosecutor improperly influenced this witness either, because as was pointed out earlier, the prosecutor didn't object to having that recommendation be redacted or not considered. So they're not improperly influencing or trying to undermine somehow their recommendation. The prosecutor did absolutely nothing to undermine the state's recommendation in this case.
Does the prosecutor have any control over that officer?
No, absolutely none, and especially considering the fact that he's a victim. If there are no further questions, we'd ask that you affirm the judgment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We asked Ms. Osborne a lot of questions. Mr. Cordell, we'll give you a minute for rebuttal if you care to take it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will.
I want to use this time to just kind of discuss a couple questions that follow up on a couple questions that Justice Papik asked Ms. Osborne. Because I think it's important to emphasize what this letter really was. I don't believe that an honest, fair assessment of this letter could be characterized as a victim impact letter. This was a letter from an investigator who made it known to the court through, whatever you want to characterize it, the badge at the bottom of the page, which in the letter contained a litany of what could only be characterized as investigative material. And I'd want to cite just, I think this language is great, in the McDonald case that we cite in the brief from the state of Washington, 346 Pacific 3rd, 748. The constitutional due process concerns that adhere when the prosecutor undercuts a plea bargain apply with equal force when the prosecution undercuts an agreement by proxy. And that's what happened here. Even if the prosecutor didn't know it, that's what happened. And Mr. Lara's rights were violated, and he deserved a new opportunity for a sentencing.
What is the assignment of error as you see it? Is this a violation of a plea agreement, or is this an abuse by the trial judge to have received something that, quote, as you just said, undercuts the agreement?
It was, oh, that's a good question. I believe it was, I can't remember exactly how it was framed. I believe the state violated the plea agreement, which constituted a violation that the court did not recognize. And we also assigned an assignment of error regarding the excessive sentence, but the brief speaks for itself on that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. That concludes arguments in State versus Lara. Hence, you are excused. And at this point in time, I think we're going to have some visitors from Blair High School join us for the last argument.